When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Player back with you on 720 WGN. So after 50 years after his death, Jimi Hendrix is celebrated as the greatest rock guitarist of all time. But before he was setting guitars and the world on fire, James Marshall Hendrix was a shy kid in Seattle plucking a broken ukulele and in fear of a father who would hit him for playing left-handed. Bringing Jimmy's story to vivid life against the new backdrop of mid-century rock, and with the wealth of new information, acclaimed music biographer Philip Norman delivers a captivating and definitive portrait of a music legend. Philip Norman is one of the most respected music biographers on the planet. He is the best-selling biographer of Eric Clapton, Buddy Holly, The Rolling Stones, John Lennon, Elton John, Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney, and of course, The Beatles. And joining us live from London is Philip Norman. Norman, welcome in.
Thank you very much.
Philip, the first book that you wrote, and looking back at all your books, was Shout, the True Story of the Beatles 40 years ago, still to this day noted as the definitive biography of the Beatles. Did you hear from any of the Beatles after it was published?
I did, sort of over time, yes. Of course, it was too late to hear from John Lennon. He'd shortly after I delivered the book to the publisher, that awful assassination took place. McCartney did contact me, and then later on, of course, I wrote McCartney's biography with his help. And then also Yoko, John's widow. I had her help when I wrote the book about John. So over time, I mean, I never expected it to last. The test of a book is supposed to be if it lasts for 10 years, but 40 years is something else.
It absolutely is. And I know that after all that, too, you noted that Yoko Ono saw you on TV in New York and phoned you at the studio and said, what you just said about John was very nice. Maybe you'd like to come over and see where we lived. And that began a whole new chapter in what you were writing.
It did, because, of course, I thought I wanted to prove that there was a story to be told about the Beatles that hadn't been told. Everyone said everybody knows everything about this, but I was sure that people didn't know the full story. And it ended up with me being shown around the apartment where John had lived with Yoko until just 5 months before, when that awful, senseless event took place, the death of John at the age of only 40, outside his home in New York. But, of course, I couldn't get away from the story and, right. And the linking stories, because the Rolling Stones I had to do because they were very much mixed up with the Beatles, and then others followed.
What brought your passion, Philip, for all things music?
Well, I was working for the Sunday Times in London, and in those days you could really go and for that. The magazine section of that paper had loads of money from advertising and would send its writers anywhere. And I just sort of took advantage of that and went a lot to the States and met people like Stevie Wonder, Wilson Pickett, James Brown, but never the Beatles, because I thought everyone else has done this story. It was only then that I realized later there was still a story to uncover. And it's a story. It's an amazing story as much as something about music.
All of your books are, and let me assume you're a fan, too, of the people you've been writing about. So I have to imagine that there is a fine line in balancing your enthusiasm for the artist and trying to be somewhat objective in what you are putting to paper.
Yes, I mean, I try to write only about what I call the tiny topmost echelon. That's the Beatles, the Stones, John Lennon, Eric Clapton, now Jimi Hendrix. You know, you mention their name anywhere in the world and you get a reaction, and you get a sort of impassioned reaction. But you have to, there's no point in writing a book about someone that you disapprove of or don't like. Like, you know, the infamous Albert Goldman would write an 800-word biography of John Lennon just slagging John off, which is completely pointless. And they're not always the best-behaved people, as you know.
Right.
You know, even if you're dealing with a monster, you have to love your monster.
You absolutely do, because you've got to make sure that your audience and the people that you're writing for are entertained by the book and not just turned off about the character in the very first chapter.
And also, in the end, sort of understand the psyche. There's often a tragic story behind these people, you know, like there is behind Jimi Hendrix and there was behind John Lennon, which explained a lot of their behavior when they achieved this enormous world fame.
And now comes Jimi Hendrix. The book follows his extraordinary rise to fame and examines the mysterious circumstances of his death at just 27 years old. How did you pick Hendrix as your next focus?
Well, it happened that the 50th anniversary of his death was coming along, and I didn't really want to do it, but somehow the book started putting itself together against my wishes. Even the man who delivered my milk in North London suddenly mentioned one day that in another life he'd been a painter and decorator, and he decorated Jimmy's flat near Marble Arch and told me all about what the flat was like. So the book started to sort of fall into my hands without my really willing it. And eventually I discovered that Jimmy's brother, younger brother Leon, was coming to Britain on a tour. Nothing like Jimmy's tours used to be. And I managed to spend quite a lot of time with Leon Hendrix and hear about how Jimmy looked after him when they were children. They had a dreadful childhood in Seattle. And Jimmy really was the surrogate dad to Leon, 5 years older. And, you know, it was an amazing story of a sort of... he was only a child himself, but he became a kind of parent to this little boy and took him everywhere and protected and looked after him.
Well, and that's the depth of this book and all your books is, you know, here's somebody, a rock icon, a music icon that's been gone for 50 years. And, you know, I'm 53, so I know just some of the basics of his background and his music. And the depth of these books are just extraordinary. And I think one of the biggest things I learned from this book, just as you said, Leanne, was a father figure that really from the very beginning is that Jimmy spent his entire life, really his entire life, trying to please his father, who never really appreciated his work or his success.
He didn't, no. His father was not a bad man, but he had no imagination, really, and he couldn't see the extraordinary talent that his older son possessed. And he had a sort of a superstitious belief, as many people did and perhaps still do, that left-handedness is a kind of mark of Satan. So if he ever caught Jimmy playing, Jimmy was left-handed guitarist, his father, Al, would just swipe him around the head in a sort of horrible, brutal way, because he thought this was a sign of, you know, Satan, and to be discouraged, but in the most brutal way. But Jimmy never bore him any grudge, always tried to please him, and never really succeeded. Even when he would buy his father a house, his father complained because the garage was too small to fit his truck so Jimmy bought him another house.
I read that. And it was an abusive childhood. It really was, but in many ways, music became a sanctuary for Hendrix.
It did, as it did for many. I mean, the stories of these major, major rock figures losing parents, particularly losing their mothers, like Jimmy's mother died when he was 14, just like Paul McCartney's mother died. Eric Clapton's mother didn't die, but really abandoned him when he was a child. There's a childhood trauma very often in the early lives of these people, and music is what rescued them. And then the 60s rescued them because they hadn't had a decent childhood in the 50s, so the 60s gave them this wonderful second childhood, which so many of them, you know, could behave like children, irresponsible kids, and nobody told them off or tried to punish them.
It's wild because there's parallels between comedians and musicians because they just really put all their energy into their work. So whether it's finding the music in their soul or finding the humor in their life, they're both kind of leading that same path.
But the extraordinary thing is, you know, that at the time this was said to Jimmy and it was said to Lennon and McCartney, you know, at the very top of the Beatles' fame, people were saying to them, this music is not going to last. You better get another career, learn to tap dance, you know, make movies. And so McCartney and Lennon wrote songs for other people because they thought they would have to be songwriters, that people, you know, the Beatles would just run their course and they would have to survive as songwriters. Jimmy as well was told by this dreadful manager, the British manager that he had, he had to work his socks off because this audience wouldn't be around for very much longer. But of course, no one imagined this music would last for another half century and more, and still be just as big today.
And nobody ever wants to hear that, obviously, getting into a profession like this. I mean, here's a guy that was self-taught. He was excited. He was enthused to get into the business. You know, Jimmy played, and these stories in here are fabulous, you know, playing early on at dances where his music was a little too wild for the people that he was entertaining. But, you know, people began to start to take notice. You know, he barely paid for his guitar when it was stolen. I mean, the guy went through so much to get to just some of these simple points.
He did indeed. And what the amazing thing about Jimmy is that although, of course, you know, the blues and R&B and soul were terrifically influential on him, it was white pop and rock music that always fascinated him. And so he ended up really breaking out of these sort of genres, you know, which was supposed to be designated as African-American, right, genres, like, right, blues and soul and R&B, and he was playing his own kind of white hard rock to white audiences. And so, you know, crossing this sort of racial boundary that certainly no other musician had done, and perhaps no one has done to this day.
He was with the Velvetones, Rocking Kings, joined the Army. When he came home, he served as a session guitarist for the likes of Tina Turner, the Isley Brothers, formed Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. Then came the Jimi Hendrix experience, but that journey, of course, was anything but easy. We're talking to renowned music biographer Philip Norman on his new Jimi Hendrix book called Wild Thing, and there's more when we come back on 720 WGN.
Wild Thing!
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to renowned biographer Philip Norman, whose works included the definitive biographies of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Eric Clapton. We're talking about the new book, Wild Thing, The Short Spellbinding Life of Jimi Hendrix. Philip, you write, and this was kind of the turning point in the book for me right away. You wrote, "One night with the usual camaraderie of British bands, the Rolling Stones, the Animals were out clubbing together with Linda Keith, who was a model dating Keith Richards at the time, and said that Chas Chandler, who was one of the original bassists for the Animals, wanted to move into management and find someone to manage. And she said, 'I've got the person for you.' And that changed everything for Jimi Hendrix."
It did. It changed, of course. And Linda Keith, who was a very, very fascinating and interesting and intelligent young woman, she really discovered Jimmy, and tried to get other people interested, including Andrew Lou Golden, the manager of the Rolling Stones. But it was eventually Chas Chandler who sort of pricked up his ears and agreed to go and see Jimmy. But Linda never got anything for this. I mean, we're discovering one of the huge talents, right, in rock history, she really, in the end, probably was the love of his life as well. Nothing, no recognition even. People don't even know her name.
And you talk about a more familiar face as Kathy Etchingham, that was his girlfriend for so long. But, you know, he built up such a following, as you mentioned, among the rock royalty, you know, with the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Eric Clapton, all of these people, you know, that truly admired his work.
That's true. And, you know, this was the age of the guitar superhero. This was the heyday of Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck. And as soon as any of them saw Jimmy on stage, they simply surrendered. They said, "We cannot compete with this man." But rather than bearing him any resentment, they adored him. They adulated him because he was an adorable person, as well as this extraordinary, not only virtuoso on the guitar, but extraordinary showman. He did things on stage that some of the old blues stars had done, sort of up to a point. But Jimmy took it much, much further, like, you know, setting his guitar on fire, playing it with his teeth. He didn't need showmanship. You know, he had virtuosity, but he gave them showmanship as well.
Well, that's another thing I walked away from this book thinking is, okay, his legacy of amazing music and then dying so young, like so many artists have. But he was really, you know, people explain to you that he was just a sweet guy. He was really a wonderful individual.
He was. I mean, you know, he was a loss to music and a loss to the human race when he died at that tragically young age. But of course, particularly in Britain, he was. There was a kind of, there was the different sort of racism in Britain, the kind of jokey racism. So sort of silly nicknames were made up for Jimmy by the music press, like the wild man from Borneo, things like that. All sort of suggesting he was some kind of untamed sort of wild creature. He was quiet and shy and not very confident. He never had confidence in his singing voice, for example. His singing voice is wonderful. It's very calm, mellifluous, kind of rather baritone, rather mellow singing voice against this amazing guitar. He didn't think he sang at all well, and he was always self-conscious about that.
Well, and there was such a lack, as we said, of support from his father and all this, too, which probably contributed to all that. But songs such as, you know, Wind Cries Mary, Foxy Lady, Purple Haze made Hendrix a global superstar. But that meant, you know, hard days, hard nights, years going on long tours. And it did take a toll on him pretty quickly.
It did. I mean, well, in fact, I mean, his great breakthrough back in America to return to his homeland and be big, just as big in the U.S. as in Europe and in Britain, was the famous Monterey Festival. But then the year after that, 1968, was a terrible year in America, torn apart by race riots, terrible reprisals by the police, assassinations. Jimmy spent virtually the whole of that year in three installments, basically one tour, with a mixed race lineup with two white sidemen, going through all the most, you know, the most virulently sort of racist parts of the country, which was an amazing feat of bravery as well as an amazing feat of musicianship.
So who he had become over the years was an absolute icon, but, you know, there's no, you know, no secret to the fact that drugs were a part of his life, but he realized at some point during his career too, okay, I've got to clean this image up. I got to book some things. I got to get some things booked that are going to change people's image of me. And he did appearances, you know, in America on the Dick Cavett show. He was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson with Flip Wilson, I think, at the time as
he
host.
Was, but, and it, you know, immediately charmed, you know, the television audience because he was so shy and so polite and so sweet. But yes, of course, he took. You know, they all smoked pot. Is what they did. But he didn't. He didn't like heroin. It was very little, not much. There's cocaine all around. But he liked to drink, really. But again, his death really. Most of these legendary figures who die at 27, it is somehow because of the excess in which they've indulged. But Jimmy was not excessive. He was quiet. He liked to. Domestic life. He liked vacuum cleaning. He liked fabrics. He was thoughtful. He was aesthetic. And so he was completely different from this extraordinary sort of wild man of the stage that was created by the media and by his own publicists.
Well, you mentioned, too, he returned to Seattle, you know, where he pretty much grew up in 1968 after 7 years not being there. He was obviously a huge star at that point. But still struggled. You said, you know, he wasn't a man of like complete excess, but he had kind of a broken heart over his father. Like still to that day, came to concert and still did not impress this guy.
No, he was seen with his fingers stuck in his ears. There was a sort of jealousy because Al Hendricks, his father, had once tried to learn the saxophone, fancied himself as a musician, and but again, there was no understanding, no empathy between them. He got on much better with Jimmy's younger brother, Leon, and Leon could do what he liked, really, with their father and get away with it. But Jimmy was always so hard on Jimmy, and Jimmy was so sweet about him and always wanted, hoped, you know, that he would somehow get through to his father. And the awful irony was that when, after Jimmy's death, leaving not very much of an estate because his manager, Mike Jeffrey, had embezzled so much of his money, he was officially domiciled in New York, and under the law at that time in New York State, his next of kin inherited his whole estate, which was his father. And, you know, this man who had never given him an ounce of encouragement or respect.
Yeah, and this is days, weeks, months leading up to his passing. He wasn't in the best of health. He was tired, you know, lack of sleep, insecurities about relationships, really a disillusionment with the music industry in general. There were some legal issues. He was now running a recording studio. There was a ton of pressure. But, you know, looking back at his life, and you do such a marvelous job in this book, really talking about each aspect of his life, he truly altered the course of popular music and became one of the most successful and influential musicians of his era, but gone long before his time.
Absolutely. You know, as I said, a loss to music, but a loss to the human race, because he truly was an adorable person.
We only touched upon a few of the stories and amazing journey of music icon Jimi Hendrix and Philip Norman's new book, Wild Thing, The Short Spellbinding Life of Jimi Hendrix. Philip, what a distinct pleasure to be able to speak with you after reading all your books for decades. And, you know, your work precedes you. And here's another example of insightful, groundbreaking work. Terrific book.
Thank you.
All right, it's 720 WGN.